Our next guest, Paul Shirky, he ranks as certainly one of the top polar adventurers and explorers in the world today. In 1977, he founded Wilderness Inquiry, which was a groundbreaking nonprofit adventure agency for disabled persons that really achieved international acclaim. Since that time, he's founded his own called the Wintergreen Expeditions, and of course, his own lodge over in Ely, Minnesota. His polar career started in 1986 when he co-led with Will Steger the historic International Polar Expedition, which resulted in a National Geographic cover story and television special, a best-selling book. I think he got personal commendations from then-President Ron Reagan on that one. And he went on later to do a Soviet-American expedition that he co-led that trekked from Siberia to Alaska, kind of a mission of adventure diplomacy that helped bring Native families together that were separated by the Iron Curtain, hadn't seen their relatives for 40 or 50 years. In 2012, Paul led an Antarctic, or actually South Georgian, ski mountaineering trek to retrace explorer Sir Ernest Shackleton's epic endurance expedition. I believe that was 1914, if I remember right. And we have him on the telephone right now from Ely. Paul, welcome to the Roadhouse.
Yeah, thank you, Buck. Good to be on with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you on, and it's going to be a lot of fun to have you over here in Cook County again. And this expedition, the Shackleton expedition, and the book Endurance that followed that, certainly one of the greatest survival stories, at least for me, in polar expedition history. Did you know that story when you were young? Did you grow up with that? And if so, was it one of your inspirations that kind of led you in the directions that you went?
Oh, absolutely. Alfred Lansing's book, Endurance, he wrote in the 50s, that recounted Shackleton's incredible experiences during that two-and-a-half-year epic expedition. Was a riveting tale that I stumbled upon back maybe junior high or earlier, and it seized my imagination, and I'm sure a large part of why Dogs in Winter have been the focus of my life ever since, I think, probably could be pinpointed back to that first reading of that amazing book, Endurance.
Can you give the folks out there just a brief overview of that expedition?
Sure. Yeah, to set the stage for it, it took place shortly after a major milestone occurred in fleshing out the last few blank spaces on the globe, and that was the discovery of the South Pole. As folks may recall, that resulted in an epic and tragic race between the Norwegian explorer Roald Amundsen, who traversed the Antarctic continent to reach the pole by dog team, in full pursuit by a British explorer, Sir Robert Falcon Scott, who sadly reached the pole as well, a month behind Amundsen, and then trundled back dispirited and despondent, and in fact, he and his companions in it died on the return to the coast of the continent. Sad saga in British exploration history. But that all set the stage for Shackleton's follow-up. That took place in 1911. A few years later, Shackleton was determined to find something yet to be done out there to flesh out the world's last unknown geographical places. And so he was determined, Shackleton in 1914, to complete the first traverse of Antarctica, not just to go to the pole, but to go right on across the entire vast white continent and to map it. But it ended up in a very different story. His expedition was a colossal failure. Neither he nor the 27 men on his crew ever set foot on the continent. But instead, sort of like the biblical story of Job, their crew endured over 2 years of a series of superhuman challenges, each one more dangerous and death-defying than the next. And in the end, Shackleton snatches triumph from complete defeat, and he secured what will surely be immortal fame by bringing his entire crew home again safely, and he's now been deemed history's greatest leader, and has been the subject ever since that epic trek. Been the subject of countless books and films and team building seminars, and the mystique about Shackleton just continues to build every year, even though we are now next year 100 years away from that trek.
Now, can you describe Shackleton's sea journey then, and Perhaps tell us a little bit about South Georgia and his, you know, his trek across it and why it was so difficult.
Well, like I say, his tale really amazingly aligns with the biblical story of Job, because it's a series of trials, each one more epic than the next. The last and begins when their ship, the Endurance, is imprisoned in the pack ice off of Antarctica's coast. Just one day before they're about to set aground on Antarctica and begin their Doxa journey, their ship is trapped in the pack ice. They're stuck. The polar winter settles in. They're caught in complete darkness, and they spend the entire next year adrift in a frozen sea and wrapped in the tremendous stress of idleness and despair and disheartenment and the slow-burning pessimism that takes its toll on the crew as they try to survive in this ship that's caught in the swirling pack ice of the polar sea. And the days become weeks, and the weeks become months. In the following spring, they're hopeful of release from the ice, but instead, quite the opposite happens. There's this massive wooden three-masted schooner, the Endurance, is crushed by the pack ice, and they watch dispiritedly as their ship, their life support system, sinks below the ice to the bottom of the South Atlantic Sea. And then Jacqueline has to completely reinvent his goal. As he recalls in his diary, our ship and our supplies are gone now. Now we go home. And he never looks back. From that point on, his entire focus is on getting his men home alive. But the bewildered crew are left stranded on this deteriorating floe of ice. With some tents and salvage rations and a few lifeboats, they scavenged from the sinking ship. So they attempt to slog their way northward towards the open sea, but it's pretty helpless because they're bucking the stiff current of the moving pack ice. And so they just end up in a survival situation, living off the ice and hunting penguins and seals as best they can. But 4 months later, the ice around them completely gives way, and now they have no choice but to cast adrift in their three small lifeboats that they had salvaged from the ship. And this wild, crazy tale is they're at sea for a week, stalked by storms and killer whales, and then they get washed ashore on this mountainous, desolate crag called Elephant Island, and they're in an absolute giddy stupor because they're marveling and picking up stones, having now standing on terra firma for the first time in nearly a year and a half. They're actually on solid ground. But they know that on this desolate crag of rock, their prospects for survival are very slim. And then this is the days before radio. They have no way of summoning help. So here's where the real tale takes a turn, because Shackleton, in a complete Hail Mary pass at attempting to save his crew, he takes five of his best crew members and one of the tiny lifeboats, called the James Caird, and he decides to set sail across the most storm-tossed sea on the planet, the South Atlantic, because their only hope for rescue is to seek help at this Norwegian whaling station, which is on this legendary place called South Georgia Island, and it's off just off the coast of Antarctica, but it's some 800 miles away from Elephant Island. And then what follows is this near three-week epic sea voyage, which is the most harrowing sea voyage on record, where for 16 near sleepless days, while they're drenched in icy seawater and parched from thirst and starving, and they get only an occasional glimpse of the sun to plot their progress, and they endure a 60-foot rogue wave that nearly seals their doom, but in the end they miraculously spot South Georgia, and they put ashore, but their boat is no longer seaworthy, yet they realize they're on they're 100 miles down the coast of the island from the nearest point of civilization, this isolated Norwegian whaling station. The island's never been mapped, it's completely uncharted, and they have no choice. They gather up their few bits and pieces of their last earthly belongings, some threadbare clothing, and they take the screws out of the hull of the boat to fasten them to the soles of their boots to provide traction, because now they know they're going to have to traverse the ice fields and mountaintops of South Georgia to try to blindly make their way traversing the island to reach the Norwegian whaling station. And this is of course, where our story merges with theirs, because their traverse of South Georgia has gone down as one of the wildest, craziest mountaineering epics ever. And so we had the amazing good fortune last fall to go down, reach South Georgia Island ourselves by ship, and retrace their route by which they traversed South Georgia. And we spent about 2 weeks on South Georgia Island and picked their way using their Shackleton's original hand-drawn maps or copies of them. We followed his route to see what it was that he that he had seen and experienced on his traverse of the island, and then arriving at this historic whaling station where they sought rescue and refuge, and then from there were able to go back to Elephant and retrieve the rest of their men, all still alive and in relatively good health, and to bring them home to England.
Wow, that was well said, Paul, that whole descriptive journey. Now, that had been retraced previously by Reinhold Messner and Conrad Anker and Stefan Venables. Why did you decide to do it again? Was it because of your love of the story?
Oh, yeah. No, it was just an absolute amazing opportunity. And, no, we weren't attempting to set any kind of a first with this. It was just a chance of a lifetime to walk in the footsteps of the giants of exploration. You know, I'd had that opportunity with Will Seeger in 1986, where we put together a Dogfit expedition that, in some respects, replicated the journey undertaken by Robert Perry in 1909, when he went down in history, although controversially still, as allegedly the first person to reach the North Pole. So whether he actually got there or not, we may never know, but now regardless of that, he's a towering giant in the history of polar exploration. And so I'd have this amazing opportunity then to walk in the footsteps of Perry's shadow at the North Pole, and then this opportunity came along to be part of, to help guide the trip in the footsteps of Shackleton's journey. So it was, you know, to get a feel for the incredible experience that he and his team had, as well as the leadership qualities that were required on his part to keep the morale up of a crew that was stuck in what appeared to be an entirely hopeless situation, not just for months, but for more than 2 years they had to endure this. And yet, he indeed may lay claim to immortality by having brought them all home alive, despite the dire circumstances that they were in day after day.
We're speaking with Paul Schuerke, and Paul, of course, a internationally renowned explorer, and we're chatting about his 2012 expedition retracing the footsteps of Ernest Shackleton as he crossed South Georgia on his epic journey. Paul, you have just an amazing resume of exploration. It fills my whole page here in one-lined sentences of each expedition, but you are really not a mountaineer, you're a polar explorer primarily. How difficult was this for you to take on a glacier, crevices, mountains? You did have, of course, Vern Tejas, I believe, was with you on that expedition, so you had an expert with you.
Oh, absolutely. No, I was completely out of my element on this one. I make no claims to have brought any particular skill set to bear on this journey, because we were there with the go-to guy for mountaineering, probably one of the world's top mountaineers. We're extremely fortunate to be tag-teaming the leadership of this with Vern Tejas, who has climbed the highest continents on the world's seven summits, not once, not twice, but 12 different times. An extremely skilled, gifted mountaineer, plus extraordinary people skills. So to have a chance to work with him, to learn from him, and to share this historic journey with him was made this opportunity all the more compelling for me.
Can you describe this trek that you and Vern, and I believe Rick Schweitzer was with you as well?
Rick Schweitzer, yeah, there were three of us, and then we had 10 other team members in our crew. And Rick and I have worked together on numerous polar projects over the years. Rick coordinates an adventure travel and expeditions business out of the Chicagoland area called Northwest Passage, and also under the name of Polar Explorers is his company. But we put ashore on South Georgia at the very same spot, a crest called Piggity Bluff, where Shackleton's little lifeboat had gotten cast ashore back in 1915. And there they realized that they had to traverse the island. The island, South Georgia Island, is a 100-mile-long spine of mountains. It just rises abruptly out of the South Polar Sea with numerous peaks in excess of 5,000 feet, and some closer to 8,000, 9,000 feet. So it's just this shimmering spine of sheer crested mountaintops with glazed with glaciers and ice caps. So we had to thread our way down that same spine to retrace their route And it's driven with crevasses and avalanche fields, so safety was paramount. And we all roped up with carabiners and climbing gear to safely reconnoiter the routes. As did Shackleton, the one item of equipment that they had no tents, they had no field rations, they had no climbing gear, they had no sleds. They carried the few little pieces of food in their socks strung across over their back, and with no tents and no sleeping bags, stopping was not an option. They just had to push right on through down across for days across this island to reach the whaling station, lest they die out there. In our case, of course, we had the luxury of having GPSs and sufficient camping gear to be comfortable out there, although the weather is no different now than it was in 1914, and the South Atlantic just sends these torrents of icy snow and wind and rain screaming across that island, and the weather changes almost hourly. So it's a very fickle place, especially when you're up at altitude. But the clinch point has this amazingly dramatic piece of topography called the Trident, because shortly into the trek that'll take you across the island, a series of mountains all converge into this kind of clenched knuckle fist of spires, and on the back side of those spires, the mountain wall drops off almost with a sheer vertical descent into oblivion, thousands of feet down. And that was what Shackleton encountered with his crew. He reached the top of the Trident as night was falling, and they looked down and into the blowing fog and the sea mist on the dark side of the mountain wall. They couldn't imagine what lay below them, nor did they really have any means of safely exploring it to see what their means might be of getting to the bottom. But they knew first and foremost they could not spend the night on the mountaintop, because the deep cold of the polar winds would have left them dead to freezing injuries by morning. So Shackleton makes this cavalier decision, knowing he really had no choice. He says, he looks at the rest of his crew members, he says, "Boys, we're just going to have to slide down this thing and see what's there." So they coiled up their little pieces of rope with which they had used to link themselves together to avoid dangers and crevasses. They coiled up that bit of rope, used it as seats to sit on. Then they sat in each other's laps like kids tobogganing together. And with a big whoop, they pushed off the precipice at the top and glissaded down, thousands of feet down, this mountain wall with no idea of what lay below them. And they recounted in their diaries that at times they were airborne in the exhilaration of traveling at that rollicking pace left them all screaming, almost giddy. And several minutes pass, and they're still picking up speed and blowing snow around them as they careen down this mountain wall, and then they actually come to a gentle glide at the bottom where it levels off onto a smooth glacier, and they're all still alive and well, no worse for wear, and they can't believe that they have made this rash decision, and they pulled it off, and they look back up the mountainside, and of course they had dodged numerous spots where they would have met their destiny if they had slipped over rocks protruding from the wall, or avalanche fields that were to the left and right of the route they happened to choose. In any case, they survived this wild, crazy journey. And we faced a similar scene when we reached the peak of the Trident. It caused us a lot of concern and angst on our journey down there, wondering how we could make this happen safely as well. And Bern and I spent considerable time reconnoitering all sides of the Trident when we got up there. We faced a scene similar to Shackleton, in that the visibility was very limited. And you couldn't really discern any details on this precipice that dropped thousands of feet below. But Vern pulled an amazing rabbit out of his hat from his years of mountaineering skills. And a preacher he had once climbed with in the Himalayas had taught him an interesting trick. And that is always, if you're caught in a situation like we were, he was taught to use what they call an avalanche dummy. You send something down the precipice that weighs more than you to see what kind of a snow line it'll create and what kind of avalanche or crevasse fields it might trigger on the way. So, on Vern's advice, we set to work carving a huge snow wheel out of the crusted snow on that mountaintop. We were able to carve this big wheel of snow that must have weighed several hundred pounds, probably 5-6 feet in diameter and 3 feet thick. With a big heave-ho, our crew got it upright and gave it a push, and in the dim light that in the blowing fog up there, it created just enough of a shadow line that we could watch that huge snow wheel work its way down, kind of wind its way, following the natural contours of the mountain wall, and we could even pick up, detect a little bit of a shadow line as it worked its way right down to the bottom onto the glacier below. And now, knowing that Snow Wheel had set us up with a relatively safe route, no avalanches were triggered, it didn't disappear into any crevasse fields, and it created a shadow line from its deep track in the powdery snow that we could now follow with our crampons and our ropes. We were able to make the descent, and much like Shackleton, when we got to the bottom, we too were giddy with laughter and hooting and hollering and had pulled it off.
Boy, that's a great story, Paul, of an amazing journey that not only is still the same today, but even with all the gear that you had and a top in flight, one of the world's best mountaineers, it still is a challenge.
It absolutely is, yeah.
Yeah. After you were able to cross South Georgia, you went through this incredible scenery, incredible place, and all the difficulties of the trek itself. Talking to Vern, one of the best mountaineers that you'll find anywhere, how did that change your view of Shackleton's, or did it at all, Shackleton's original feat?
Yeah, it did change my view of Shackleton in that although they laid their lives on the line when they descended the Trident Peak, their little human toboggan ride, but yet when you read the tale that follows, in the rest of his life, he was a very Shackleton, although he brought his entire crew home alive and well to London and was feted as royalty and had the world by the tail and could have pursued any interest that he chose, given the access he had then to people and places of power. Nonetheless, he was a very unsettled man. Life had sort of begun and ended for him at that epic moment at the Trident Peaks, and he recounts that numerous times in his diary in the years that follow. And in fact, some years after his return home, that unsettled element of his nature drove him to go back down there. And in 1922, he cobbles together some kind of a loose-knit plan for an expedition called the Odyssey. He puts out a call to some of the same men who had been with him through that wild endurance expedition several years prior. Most all of them say, take me, I'm on board again. And so they set sail to head down to South Georgia. And sometime later they reached the coast of South Georgia. And Shackleton recounts in his diary that his heart is pumping as he sees that majestic place and the beauty of the island and that peak, the Trident, where their fate had been determined by that whimsical bit of luck that they'd had. He sets ashore on the island, kisses the ground, can't believe he's back there again. But then an odd thing happens. He returns to his cabin on board the boat that night, and much to the shock and dismay of the entire team, he passes away of a heart attack. He's still a relatively young man then. But it was almost then in the days that followed, there was several of his teammates were led to wonder if he'd actually kind of gone down there on a death wish, that nothing back home had made sense again about the workaday world of living in London, even with his family, or the various opportunities he had back home, that something, some life experience had peaked there on South Georgia, and his heart was set on just going back and making what more or less ended up being a permanent pilgrimage back to that island, which he... Of course, then, in fact, he is buried there on South Georgia in the Whaler Cemetery at this historic whaling station. And so our journey itself ended up being a pilgrimage, too, because we finished our trek right there at Shackleton's grave in the Whaler Cemetery, where his soul resides in that island where life had taken such an odd turn for him.
Paul, before I let you go, though, I would like to also talk about your business. And I was... Of course, most of us here know your wintergreen business from all these years you've been so active in Ely. I was surprised because I hadn't heard, you don't tout it very much, but all of the awards that your business has won, and Outside Magazine naming your business one of the top 10 most innovative and influential small outdoor businesses. Then again, you were in the top 6 in a PBS TV series, The Best Adventure Lodges of North America. Can you briefly give folks an idea of how they can take a look at your business online, perhaps, and maybe some of your other adventures may be there as well?
Well, I appreciate that, Buck. Yeah, and winter and dogs in winter have been a way of life for us here, for Sue and I, and our whole family ever since we've called Ely home now. We've been here some 30 years, but easy to take a look at it because years ago, way back before I ever heard anything about the Internet or the World Wide Web or any of that, some friend told me, he said, "Hey, Paul, I'm going to do you a big favor. I'm going to buy you something called a URL." And the URL he bought me was dogsledding.com. So I lucked out. I had no idea what it was I was buying at the time, but we got in while the getting was good on website addresses, and so our lodge operations are spelled out there, and yeah, we've enjoyed the recognitions we've got, although frankly we just enjoy being out in the winter with the dogs and sharing the winter woods and the barn waters here, and it's lovely snow season splendor with people from all over the world that come to join us on these trips. And this afternoon, we're all running the dogs. We've got, today was the most wintry day we've had yet this season, and tomorrow it sounds like we're going to see even more winter. We've had snow flurries off and on all day here, but it was enough to get the dogs excited and us too, so we're running.
Well, that's just great. It was sure great to talk to you, Paul. I want to thank you so much for giving us your time. That's Paul Shirky. Paul, thanks again for joining us here.
Thank you, Buck.